song is Yesterday's Gone, done by Kelly Willard. It's 11 and a half minutes after the hour. It is a Tuesday morning, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist by trade, actually a vigneron by trade now. He used to be a biochemist, still works around. Well, he needs all that chemistry for his wine work now, so it's a good thing he is a biochemist. And also a member of the board at Creation Moments, and he joins us every Tuesday morning. We talk about things like, evolution and faith and science and Don, you're a delight to have. We're glad that you're back. You traveled last week. We missed you.
Oh, we did travel. I traveled quite a bit last week, actually. I flew up to the Cleveland area. Actually, I flew into Akron, but then drove to Cleveland.
Okay.
And helped my daughter's ministry dance company in Cleveland called Elo Dance Company.
Mm-hmm.
And we have one of our ministries, Abide 154, does a helps ministry where we help smaller ministries with their keeping their books, basically.
Yeah, okay. The business end of it. Then, yeah.
Yeah, so the administrative end, the business end. So we've been struggling back and forth with how can we do this efficiently, and the folks up there were entering them into spreadsheets and then sending us the spreadsheets, and then we'd enter it into QuickBooks and into our donor database. So it was inefficient, so I went up there and basically taught them how to use QuickBooks online.
So I presume this would be like a trade arrangement where you would teach them to do QuickBooks and they would teach you how to dance?
That was suggested. Mm-hmm. Okay. That was suggested. I was in their studio and they had me doing some exercises.
Good.
When it got to the two-step, I got lost on the first step, so it wasn't going to happen.
PHYS.org, there's an article there, and it talks about scientists, and they're patting themselves on the back, that finally they've solved a fish evolution mystery. They've been looking at, these are some folks from the University of Wyoming, and they've been researching the Lake Victoria region in East Africa. And wondering in the lakes, how come there are so many fish here, so many different kinds of fish? And they're saying, well, they've just now discovered how more than 700 species of fish have evolved in that region, in those lakes, over the past 150,000 years. Now, there are a couple of assumptions there that I would immediately question, and maybe it's just the way they write the headlines here. Well, one, they assume 150,000 years because they don't know any better. And 700 species, if they just discovered those, how many more might there be? I mean, this is like partial information here. And I love it when science discovers when they've been befuddled before and changed their opinions. And that's kind of what it looks like here. Catherine Wagner is a University of Wyoming assistant professor, and she works at the Department of Botany and with the Wyoming Biodiversity Institute. She describes the phenomenon unparalleled in the animal and plant world, well, I would suggest, how do you know, as one of the most spectacular examples of the evolution of modern biodiversity. And Don, I would have to conclude from that statement that they have found fish that used to be antelope, and fish that used to be hippopotamuses, and somehow they've changed into fish here.
One was a golden shepherd.
Yeah.
Well, those spectacular statements would certainly suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also suggesting that quick evolutionary process from whatever it was until it was a fish, took a very short evolutionary time scale. Mm-hmm. And that was, remarkable.
Yeah, 150,000 years is just a drop in the bucket on the evolutionary time scale, isn't it? Yeah.
So here's what we're dealing with, though. If you get into the article, you'll find, and I'll explain why this is a little bit unusual. But they're dealing with cichlids. So all the fish that they're dealing with, all of these 700 different species. Now, what makes up a species, a different species? Well, it could have a different color.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a bottom feeder as opposed to scraping algae off a rock. It can eat insects or, snails or whatever. It could eat, something else, and they'll call it a different species. Its fins could be slightly different than another, and so we're dealing with variation on the kind. So if you reinterpret this this whole article, what you get is that, hey, you know, God is really super, because he's designed within us this ability to have slight variations within a kind, and that variation within a kind can happen very, very rapidly. Now, obviously, I dispute the 150,000 years, but the variations, these folks, of course, you know, her specialty is evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. And so she's going to try to find the evidence of, we're trying to understand the evolution, the biology of evolution.
Well, understand and reinforce it. I mean, it's a predisposition to accept evolution just in her title.
Well, I guess you probably haven't heard that evolution is fact, and so as such, we don't need to dispute it anymore, as if, these crazy creationists you would think that this isn't an example of modern evolution. Now, I'm being sarcastic, obviously, but... Yes, it's interesting how your presuppositions clouds your interpretation. But the interesting thing, the real interesting thing about this article is that, okay, in Lake Victoria in Africa, we have cichlids, and there are at least 700 different, in quote, species. So there's something different about, you know, these fish, and they look kind of different, as I explained before. But there's also other types of fish, not cichlids, but other types of fish that are relatively unchanged. And so that was actually the puzzle. How could you have a group of fish, fish are relatively unchanged, but other fish of a certain species, called cichlids, how come there's so much variation in them? So that's what she went about trying to solve this puzzle, and came to the conclusion that, there were originally two different kinds of cichlids. One was from the Nile River, and one was from the Congo. And there must have been some type of heavy rains or something. So it flooded, and these two, species, if you will, still cichlids, by the way, happened to get together and wind up in Lake Victoria. And then they started the whole ball rolling, and that's why we have so many. That's the essence of the article, and so let's kind of reinterpret it from a creationist point of view. First of all, they're all of the same type of fish.
Yeah, right? They all look like fish, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're fish.
Looking at pictures of them here, yeah.
To give the audience a little bit of hint to what a cichlid is, well, if you go to a pet shop and you're looking at the tropical fish, you'll see several cichlids. In one, which is quite famous, is the angelfish. So, when you say angelfish, everybody knows what an angelfish is, and that's a cichlid. And so we're talking about, relatives... of the angelfish. Now, the angelfish isn't in this Lake Victoria, as far as the pictures are showing, but there's other cichlids that are there, and so we're talking about a popular, common tropical fish. Some not so big, some maybe a little bit bigger, and all of this points to variation on the kind. Well, how fast does variation on the kind work? And as in this example, it can go pretty fast. And if you actually read the article further down, they kind of say that this probably happened in about 1,000 years, a couple of thousand years, not 150,000 years. They're thinking that, oh, gee, the flood happened 150,000 years, or this mixing of these two different type of cichlids, and so the whole process of all of this, all these fish, different colors and different shapes of fish developing, what happened within a short period of time. And how do they know? I mean, how did they trace the parentage, if you will, of these fish? Well, they did. They looked at DNA markers, and it's kind of very similar to what 23andMe does. It looks at DNA markers for us, and if you send in a saliva sample or something, and they'll test your DNA and say, oh, you've got 15% Italian and 10% Viking, and they'll break down
your
heritage.
Get your own personal pie chart.
Have you ever done that, Don?
I have never done that. Okay. No, my son, one of my sons has done it, and lo and behold, he found out that part of his lineage was Italian. Well, I'm about half Italian. My mother and grandmother and her relatives were all Italian, and so that's where that came from. And I'm also Scotch-Irish, so I would anticipate that I'd have a larger percentage of Scotch-Irish. Now, is there something else in there? I am sure there is, because it's been a long time since Noah and the flood. So we've had time to mix, and lo and behold, from the eight, or actually from the eight that was on the original ark to what we have today, billions of people, we've got a lot of variation on the kind. I mean, I would still call us humans. Some people would argue that, well, some are more human than others. And obviously some have, more ape-like qualities, and some have, bigger heads, so they've got to be smarter, right? But this is all variation on a kind.
Now, is this what they refer to as epigenetics? Variations that happen as a result of environment?
Well, we've talked about epigenetics, and it's interesting that you brought that up, because they don't talk about it in the article.
Not at all.
But, and it would be interesting if they would indeed look at that, because what is epigenetics? Well, in essence, it is environmental factors, or, for humans, mental factors can also influence your DNA. And how does it influence it? Well, basically there's methylation enzymes that go around and methylate the sugar, sugars on your DNA. And your DNA has a sugar backbone, a phosphate sugar backbone. That then alters the way genes are expressed. And one of my favorite examples would be, if you have a lot of fear in your life, then that fear is going to imprint itself on the DNA, we know now, in this process called epigenetics. And so when you have children, if you have a lot of fear in your life, then your children are in a higher risk of having fear in their lives, because their DNA has been programmed, if you will, to fear. Now you say, oh, that's crazy. I mean, how could, something like a component of it obviously is emotional, and we could talk about all the various components of fear, but how could something like that be passed on to your children? Well, we know scripturally that it does, because, if you don't keep God's commandments, then the sins of the father get passed to the children, to the third and fourth generation.
You know, I'd never looked at it that way, as being genetic. I'd always looked at it as, well, God will hold them accountable for what you did. That's not what it's saying, is it?
Well, I mean, yes, it is. Mm-hmm. There is a moral, you know, kind of standard that God has placed. And you can see why that might be, because, look, fathers, mm-hmm. walk in a righteous way, because your behavior is not only affecting you, it's affecting your children and your children's children and their children's children, mm-hmm. and, you know, down to the third and fourth generation. So with that, armed with that knowledge, then I might be more inclined to say, oh, I guess I'm not going to sin that way, because that's going to affect my kids.
Well, I could see the moral discipline aspect, but to think, and they would have had no clue that there was something called DNA that could be, that you could imprint this, some of the same characteristics and pass them on. I mean, even emotional characteristics. We figure, well, we decide what we're going to be afraid of. It's an optional kind of thing here, or it's imposed on us from the outside. But you're saying that somehow we can inherit a tendency to be afraid?
Yes. Yes, in a process called epigenetics, which is this modification of the DNA that then gets passed on, you know, to our children. Mm. And I see examples of that. And if you start watching for it, you would too. And you could say, well, and you can explain it from another number of different ways. But, you know, I find it fascinating that God actually built a mechanism for it. Now, on the contrary to that, or the corollary to that, is that if you live in peace, guess what your children get? They get peace.
Hmm.
Right? So, and you can, if you come out of fear, for example, I mean, we're just talking about fear, but there's many other things that, you know, affect this process. Mm-hmm. But if you come out of fear and you go into peace, then you change your DNA. It's like God kind of rewrites your DNA. And then you have children, and then that peace gets carried on to them. And the Bible says, you know, if you live righteously, then, you know, my blessings will go to the thousands of generations, you know, past you. So there's a good motivation to behave righteously as opposed to not so. But, okay, now let's take this epigenetic example then. How can we apply that to the fish? Is this same mechanism working in the fish or working in all animals?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe, I haven't read or seen any studies of this, but my guess would be, and it's just a guess, it's just a hypothesis, it's just, you know, it's something you would throw out and say, let's test it.
Well, you know, if you look at what we've done with agriculture over the eons, you know, crossbreeding seeds from weather-hardy plants with plants with more protein and this and that, you get a hybrid that has characteristics of both that would be consistent with what you're describing.
And how did those characteristics come about? And what makes those characteristics in the first place? Well, let's take the cichlids, for example. There's some, like I said, that eat the algae off the rocks, and so they live higher up in the lake. And there are some that are on the bottom, the murky, murky, dark bottom. And one would say, oh, they've adapted to their environment. And the cichlids that live on the bottom have babies, and their babies live on the bottom. They don't go up to the top, you know, searching for algae. So it's like they've been imprinted with the instinct to live in that environment. I would hypothesize that imprinting is actually could actually be due to epigenetics, and you know, not due to something else. I mean, it's like, you know, some of these poor fish, you know, wound up on the bottom, and then found food, and so they kind of stayed there. But that behavior in the environment then imprinted on their DNA, and their offspring then had a tendency to, you know, be bottom feeders as opposed to be top, you know, algae feeders or insect feeders. So I suspect that as the scientific community delves more and more into this this whole epigenetic areas, you know, they'll find that, oh, you know, gee, it's not only happening in humans, but it also apparently occurs, you know, with all different types of animals, and can then help explain the different behaviors of the same kind of animal, but let's say isolated in a different location. And there, you know, there may be other gross genetic changes other than the subtle changes that happen.
Well, they're looking at their drawings, and I presume these drawings of the fish represent the actual critters, but some of them are kind of golden striped, some are kind of red, some have a blue hue, some are larger, some are smaller, but they're all fish, and they're all cichlids still. And what strikes me about this article is they've looked at this and said, well, this has happened in only 150,000 years? And instead of saying, well, then it couldn't have been evolution because it takes eons, millions of years for this to happen, it must be something else. Instead of that, they said, well, evolution happens fast, too. You know, there's a logical leap there that leads one into deeper error, I think. Or at least you should question that. Question your premises. When you see a contradiction, you should question the premises.
Well, you can't, and this is what's, you know, these folks like to do. They like to confuse folks and say, yes, oh, obviously that is definitely, you know, a factor for evolution. I mean, this is obviously an example of evolution, and from here on out, you know, this will be written into the textbooks as examples of evolution. Mm-hmm. And it's no such thing. It's examples of variation on a kind. Mm-hmm.
It actually contradicts the earlier precepts concerning evolution. And yet they categorize it as evolution, so they alter their definition to fit the circumstance.
Right. And they, you know, evolutionists will do this, you know, constantly pointing to variations within a kind and say, oh, this is obviously examples of evolution when it's not. It's just variations of the same kind. In this case, the parents, you know, weren't that different from one another. Oh, they may have been striped differently. And, you know, some may have had, you know, a little bit bigger fins than the others. But when they all get together, you get a whole different, you know, variation. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see in the world today. When we just look at humans and say, oh, gee, there's a lot of different humans. Now, we call them races, but... You know, why do we call them races instead of you're a different species? You see, yeah. We've got the Asian species. Mm-hmm. We've got the North European species. We've got the African species. You know, why are we changing our nomenclature, you know, for fish? I mean, mm-hmm. Or at least for humans. But that makes it sound like, oh, you know, you are different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what does the Bible say, in which, you know, the founding of this country was, you know, all men are created equal, right? So when you start calling the Asians a different species and the Europeans a different species and the Africans a different species and the Jews are obviously a different species, and the Middle Easterners are different species, and the Jews are a different mm-hmm. species than the Muslims in the Middle East. That's why, you know, they can't get along, because they're different species. I mean, this is crazy language, but this happens all the time in biology. with different animals.
Well, I have a question for you then. In the Bible, you find a phrase, after their kind. And I do believe that every word in the Bible is important. So that phrase must be there for a reason. What does that phrase teach us, after their kind?
Well, it teaches us that a apple is not going to turn into a orange, for example. Now, we have different types of apples. It doesn't say that the kind can't differentiate into various types of kinds. I mean, it's the same kind, but it's, you know, an apple's still an apple. Whether you have a granny apple or you have a sweet apple or honey sweet apple or whatever they're called. You know, it's still an apple. I mean, you could look at it and you'd say, I can identify that as an apple. Mm-hmm. And that's what a kind is. And if you want to get into a little bit more depth, although this kind of breaks down a little bit, is the DNA is so similar between that apple and this other apple that you can put them together and, you know, form an intermediate, you know, apple, for example. In other words, and speaking of, let's do it with animals. I mean, the DNA of one species, if the DNA of one species, if the parents can mate and produce offspring, viable offspring, then they are of the same kind. Now, you have a little bit of problem because there is a northern, you know, rabbit and a southern rabbit. The northern rabbit's white. The southern rabbit's kind of brown. There's an intermediate rabbit. Now, the northern rabbit, if bred with the southern rabbit, does not produce offspring because their genetics have diverged, far enough. But the intermediate rabbit can breed successfully with the northern rabbit, and the intermediate rabbit can breed successfully with the southern rabbit.
That's
and so the conclusion is that it's this: the rabbits are the same kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just that their DNA is some have diverged, where you know the DNA comes together, one from the mother and one from the father, that it doesn't quite fit, and so therefore it's not producing the same type of
there's a lesson looking at the inverse process as well, because and I'm no expert in this, you would know, but if you get a hybrid plant, for example, let's say it's a tomato plant, or let's say it's a tree, because you can go down to the nursery and you can buy a tree into which has been grafted different kinds of fruit that will all work in that area, and that tree can produce, you know, 2, 3, 4 different kinds of fruit for you. But if you take the seeds and plant them, you don't get a tree that produces mixed fruit. You get one or the other of those fruits. Or if it's a hybrid plant and you plant the seeds, it doesn't produce another hybrid. It goes back to the basic genetical structure of the two or more plants that were combined to make the hybrid. So it returns to its basic kind. That says there's a lot of work here.
Yeah. Yes. Well, the grafting is a kind of a different story. But the hybridization... And, you know, somewhere in this article, they talked about hybridization, and that's, kind of the process that's going on. You're mixing different DNA together, and you're getting something in between. But yes, in agriculture, of course, you know, there's a lot of hybridization that's gone on. But if you take the seeds of that wheat, for example, and then plant that, and then plant, you know, the seeds of the seeds, if you will, grow the wheat up, it's going to be different than the hybrid. The hybrid, you know, is the reason why they even sell the hybrid, is because it's got certain qualities that you're looking for. And so the seeds of that hybrid, if you tried to plant it, won't be like that as you described of what you bought initially, it goes back to more of a native, what we would call, you know, a native wheat or a native grass,
a parent strain of whatever the organism was.
Yeah. Right.
That's also good marketing, because if you're selling that, they got to come back to you and buy more if they want the same characteristics.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that is indeed what happens. Mm-hmm. So if you get stuck on, tomatoes. I mean, you get to, the nice, big, juicy tomatoes. Well, that's a hybrid tomato. It may, in matter of fact, with plants and agriculture, there's more than one copy of the DNA. I mean, corn, for example, hybridized corn has like six to eight different copies of DNA, and it's what makes the kernel so big. Mm-hmm. But you try to plant one of those kernels, it's either infertile and you can't get anything from it, or, as we said, it goes back to a reasonable number of DNA mm-hmm. copies so that, it can survive,
well, it goes, if you will, back to the basic form of the kind, eventually. Mm-hmm. So a kind is a kind forever. But within that kind, there can be variations, and that's epigenetics when it's caused by the environment.
Right. Yeah. The environment, as I said, can indeed modify your DNA. So it expresses different genes. It's not that there's new genes there. It's that the genes are already present. That's the basis of evolution is that, oh, my goodness, we're creating new genes. Hogwash. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is that we're expressing, for whatever reason, we're expressing because of mix of different DNAs. We know that there's crossover and different things happen during the fertilization process. But, all of this is not creating new information. The information's already there. It's just expressing itself mm-hmm. differently.
It is adapting to its environment by one or more of those characteristics coming to the fore. Because it's already there. It already has that ability to adapt. David, you had a question a while ago, and I suspect if this conversation has gone routinely, you have forgotten what it was. did you want to ask it now, Dave?
We do know each other really relatively well, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
I don't remember what the question was. All right. I think it had something to do with fish.
Well, the real question is, how do they taste? How do they taste?
Well, and if they're the size of angelfish, you're going to have to get a bunch of them before you even get a taste.
I think so.
That's very interesting. And I guess one of the things that I was thinking about when you were talking about hybrids and crops is that that's one of the reasons that that the one seed company is so incredibly wealthy, because they go out and sue people if they don't buy new corn plants or new corn seed every year, if they use some of the old stuff, or if some of the pollen from a different strain drifts over into somebody else's field, the farmer could be sued. Monsanto is the name of the company that I'm thinking about.
There you go.
And the one of the things I guess I didn't realize is that if you plant a hybrid or a seed from a hybrid, it will go back to a previous form. I wasn't aware of that. That's new information for me. I thought that a hybrid is kind of like it's either a donkey or a burro, and it won't reproduce because it's a hybrid.
Well, mules, right?
A cross between a horse and a
horse and a mule.
Yeah,
a horse and a donkey becomes and it won't produce or reproduce. Yeah, yeah, it won't reproduce because it's for whatever reason. Now, maybe this is subject for another program, but why doesn't it? Why doesn't it revert to one of the former or one of the previous forms? Anybody?
Why doesn't it revert?
Talk to a
horse. The sterile offspring?
Yeah.
Well, because the genetics has diverged, so much that it no longer, functional kind of on its own, if you will, in that case. Yep. And so we can force things to happen. Now, the interesting thing is that both the donkey or the ass and a horse they say that the donkey is in the horse family. Mm. I would interpret that to say that the donkey is in the horse kind.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it diverged because of environment and all and other things into what we commonly call today a donkey. Mm. You can get far enough away from those, from that when the donkey, I'm looking at the definition of a mule. A mule is an offspring of a male donkey or a jack and a female horse or mare. So the mule is the animal that doesn't reproduce, mm-hmm. and the chromosomes are just too divergent at that point between the donkey and the mule and the horse that its offspring is not viable, to reproduce.
So, I know what I was thinking about before when you thought you saw the question in my eyes, Jim. Is that, you know, we were talking about why don't we discuss people of different races as a separate species? And you know, and I'm thinking to myself, how many of my liberal friends their heads are exploding right now if somebody called the Jewish person a separate species or the black person a separate species? I can imagine all these heads spinning around and saying, what?
Mm-hmm.
they're going crazy out there. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's a fascinating topic, and we've explored it, and I think we're gonna maybe we could pick it up next week if you'd like. Although some other topic may well arise twixt now and then. But Dr. Don Clark, down in Garden Valley, Texas, a biochemist and a member of the Board of Creation Moments. By the way, you can visit the Creation Moments website. I would recommend you do that. CreationMoments.com. And you can link to it from Broken Road Radio. You'll discover a lot of scientific information there that supports, speaks very convincingly about the biblical creation story. And you'll find it quite valuable and quite fascinating. There'll be some surprises there for you. I guarantee you, creationmoments.com. Don, thanks very much for joining us, and have a good week. We'll see you next week, okay?
Okay, very good. You folks have a great week, too.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Okay, see you, Don.
So long.